Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
Amazing. Let's get started. Welcome, everybody, to Leveling Up as a Product Leader, this week's Executive Roundtable with Bring Ruckus. My name is Casey Baldwin. I am the Director of Marketing and Platform at Bring Ruckus, and I'm really excited to be here. With that, I will pass the microphone over to our founder and CEO, Anish Shah, who will moderate today's conversation.
Hi, everybody. So quick introductions. So my background was working in marketing and growth for different companies for about a decade and then started an executive recruiting firm. And so now we're a team of 20, recruiting for a wide variety of searches across quite a few different companies, both sort of large and small.
Let me jump in. Hi, I'm Jeannie Yang. My background is in actually engineering, but I've been in product for a while. Currently, I'm at a company called Smart News. We deliver quality information to people all over the world. We're located in Japan, US, China as well. And so currently lead the product division. We have design, data science, product management, operations across the board here. So,
hi, everyone. I'm Catherine Fisher. For the last 7.5 years, I've been at First Dibs working on product, which is an online marketplace for one-of-a-kind luxury goods. You can buy furniture, art, fashion, and jewelry, very high-end items from dealers all over the world. So it's a two-sided marketplace. It's global. Our buyers and sellers all over the world and a high price point. So my last day there actually was last week. And so I'm going through a little bit of fun employment for a short period of time. And then I'll be starting as the VP of product at Made Renovation to lead their product team. So they are looking to turn the messy home renovation process into a seamless e-commerce experience. So it's a small product team now, but we'll be growing that team out and should be really interesting. There's also a two-sided marketplace with general contractors and designers. So anyway, excited to be here.
And hello, I'm Lucy Huang. I'm a product leader here in New York City. Today, I'm focused on growing Storyblocks by leading the product team. So product team here means product management, design, growth, as well as UX research. So with Storyblocks, we are a motion for a rapid video creation platform. So what it means is we help creators, both enterprises and consumer side, to be able to create your videos. So that means offering everything from content to as well as a video editor to help you create your stories very quickly. So yeah, so I love the growth stage company, have been doing product at growth stage companies for a while now. So started out my career actually in finance. So everything, I would say product is one of those roles, right? Everything you do actually helps you out to give you a more holistic view.
Absolutely. What is the big thing that you want to be measured on as a product leader? And this is interesting because it can go in a lot of different directions and every organization maybe might think about measuring it in a different way. So, you know, number one, what do you think would be kind of like the North Star for a great product leader? And then also, have you seen different organizations measure it in different ways and had any sort of like pros and cons with the different ways they think about it?
I think just very, very high level, one of the most important things from product is to just make sure you're measured on your impact versus your output. So I think it's really, really easy to get into the world of releasing features, releasing bug fixes. You can do a lot and you can keep engineers really busy and do cool things. But at the end of the day, it's really about how does the product team impact the business as a whole? So the bottom line, how are you driving sales? How are you lowering costs? How are you driving more users? Whatever it is. And there's a lot of things, you know, metrics that, you know, bubble up to that. But ultimately, it's really your impact on sort of the health and growth of the business, while also being mindful that you can only control so much, right? There's a lot of other influences about in the impact. It's marketing, it's operations, et cetera. But yeah, that's a very, very high level answer just to kick it off, I guess.
That's great because you can spin your wheels doing a bunch of tasks, but is it actually driving whatever your goal is? And have you seen even what that goal is be a little bit different with different companies? You mentioned impact in some organizations. Is that more revenue? Some organizations, is it more just a better, more kind of engaging product? There are different ways that you can sort of measure that.
I think it depends on the type of business. So for example, there, if it's more of an enterprise SaaS type of business versus like a self-serve, So if it's more of an enterprise SaaS type of business, then I would say product impact is sort of a little bit of like a dotted line. So very much agree with Catherine, you want to be measured on impact. And that's both customer impact as well as end business impact. So in an enterprise business where you do go through kind of product marketing and sales folks, you know, you can't go out there as a product manager or a product leader, you don't go out there and kind of sell the product yourself. So a lot of the times what you want to do is actually thinking about customer usage on the SaaS product, which ultimately goes into retention and also sometimes acquisition as well. So that's one piece that, depending on the type of business. And I would say on the self-service type of business, and again, depending on which area of product that you work on, that it's less of a dotted line. Sometimes you can draw a bit more of a straight line in terms of what the product team is doing versus, you know, how much are we contributing to acquisition? How much are we contributing to retention?
Yeah, I cannot agree more with what Catherine and Lucy said. So I don't have much to add to that, but maybe something personally for me, I think over the years, as I've learned, is also as we're doing this, I think this is related to the question in the chat, you know, how does that differ between product lead versus IC? Actually, it's also for me, like my team members' growth and their impact is ultimately how all the individual members' teams' impact add up to the overall impact. So I think some of the most gratifying things is seeing people grow and achieve their successes, because ultimately their success becomes your success. So it's gratifying, like how are they growing us from product to different aspects of their career is one of the most gratifying things. And personally, you know, how do I strive to sort of like having a team be more self-sufficient without me, so I'm able to move on to different parts as well. And so that's actually, at least for me personally, something now that I've learned and grow those aspects, right? So it's impact of the team members, but it's also their personal growth and their career growth. That's actually one of the most gratifying, because they'll achieve that through making impact in the product.
You can kind of ladder it up, right? Going back to the question in the chat, where it's like, as a product lead or just a product leader, you know, you're probably setting goals at a really high level, right? It's going to be, again, we need new users, we need traffic, we need X percent conversion, right? You're going to have some really lofty, big goals. And there's probably going to be several teams, like they have smaller individual goals that ladder up to those bigger goals. And so those individual contributors and those teams, you know, theirs might be really just focused on traffic or a very specific part of a funnel or whatnot. But then if you add those up together, then the team and all those teams together can then reach those like larger business goals together.
Makes a lot of sense. And if there was some way to gauge, like, have I really grown the team reporting into me and made them, you know, better product managers, which overall help the organization, would that be maybe via like promotions or via their output and metrics improving over time? Has there been anything that's been sort of interesting that you've been like, okay, this makes me feel like I've done a really good job and I'm able to actually communicate this upward that, you know, I've done a good job of growing the internal product management team reporting into me. And I've been able to communicate that because of this to show for it.
I think that's definitely the most obvious and direct way to see how that happens. I think personally for me is when I have a team member now start pushing back on me, questioning me on everything. And then they're taking it like, great, you go to that meeting and you feel that. But obviously the best impact is actually giving that recognition, that reward. But it's either through promotions, either through how they have discovered. Maybe it's not in this company, because I do think people grow and they find new opportunities. That's also incredibly gratifying when people see and they take on bigger opportunities or different aspects of it. So there's definitely the very direct one, Anish, to show that impact and they're recognized through whatever reward or mechanism, promotion, et cetera. But I think always targeting that promotion make people very narrow focused. So I think the thing is like, how are they actually taking on more of that scope? How are they actually showing that presence and being in more of those meetings with executive leadership, giving that opportunity, and they're directly able to push back in a convincing way as well, I think shows really signs of growth. And then also whatever opportunities they're pushing for next is always really gratifying to see.
I just want to double down on Jeannie's point in the sense of growing people. So I love what you said here. And I think some of it, when we think about outcomes, so as a product leader, I think your people, they're early indicators and then they're lagging indicators. I'm a pretty fairly quantitative product leader, as I'm showing. So some of the early indicators, to your point, Jeannie, it's like being able to push back, being able to literally take a load off of your shoulders because you have coached your team enough that your team can now run really autonomously and have that critical thinking. And because of that, as a product leader, now you're freed up to address other areas of the business as well as taking on more. So you're seeing that as early indicators. And then I would say some of the lagging indicators is the business results. If you're in more of a kind of an e-commerce type of business, like Catherine is saying, like you can literally see traffic going up or like funnel conversion, that could be a part of it, or any sort of customer impact, I think that's more of a lagging indicator in terms of your impact on your people. And promotion is also a lagging indicator to that.
You just said it way better, Lucy. Thank you. That was great.
Both were great. And thanks a lot for digging into that. Let's jump to the next. This is really interesting. So maybe biggest might be a little bit too hard to figure out, but what are some different challenges that you faced in managing engineering and stakeholder expectations? And I'd imagine since you're wedged in between so many different teams that the different stakeholders want completely different things at times, where the engineers might want one thing, the business leads might want one thing, the marketers want another thing. And so any tips or tricks that you've learned in trying to move forward and figure out how to make all ends kind of successful?
Well, I think something that I've been thinking a lot about in the last, I don't know, 6 months in terms of managing stakeholder expectations has been around thinking about managing up sort of the impact of newer features and MVPs. So what sometimes has been an issue I've seen in the past is, you know, you make this case for a product and you're going to build this thing and you're going to invest some time. Most products, they're not going to have an impact immediately, right? It's not just going to be like overnight, cool, we've hit our goal, like we're good to go, right? There's infrastructure that maybe has to be in place and there's an MVP and then you build on top of that, right? To keep building and building. And I've seen in the past, sometimes, you know, people being like, wait, how come we're doing more work on this? How come this is taking longer? You know, oh, I thought we were going to be done. No, we were really beta testing, you know, something. And then once we prove that out, okay, now we're going to go ahead and move forward with this for other verticals or whatnot. So something that I've learned a lot over the last, again, I would say kind of 6 to 12 months, just with some projects I was working on, was just how important it is, particularly with, you know, managing up, is being really explicit about, especially things that take a little bit longer, you know, what the outcome will be and what the impact will be on the bottom line at certain points, because again, it might not hit immediately. And so everyone's really clear on the investment too, that you're going to have to make. You're going to need people working on something, you know, for a period of time. So anyway, that's something that I've been thinking about a lot.
Makes a lot of sense. It sounds very foundational as well, right? Versus just like, hey, we're going to put this out in the world. You know, here's some features. Here's some sticky things that we're going to do that are going to make people enjoy our product. It's like, no, there's a lot of investment that goes into that. And oftentimes it may not be communicated well how much investment goes through, especially when someone maybe at the board level or the executive level just says, hey, I want this. Can we just like turn this around and turn it on in a couple of weeks?
Yeah. And there's a lot of conversations that happen. I think in every meeting, you're not going to have every single person in that meeting. There's a lot of smaller meetings with different people and there's different information that people get. And, you know, finance has a very different perspective than marketing, that has been operations. And so pulling that together so that all of those expectations are aligned is really important.
Makes a lot of sense.
I'd love to know, Catherine, if you have any framework for managing that timeline of expectations, because that's definitely, I think, a constant.
Yeah, I think just trying to be explicit about, like, particularly, like, what the outcome will be. Like, great, we're going to do this thing, and making sure really at the exact level that you're very clear of, we're going to do this thing, but it's a milestone, you know, that'll hit in 3 months. What is, again, that output? And then making very clear, they're like literally saying the words, we will need more investment of X amount or X amount of time. We think by X date, is it next year or whatever our goal is to get to this. But just being, I think sometimes those can get lost in more casual conversations and you don't always say those things explicitly. So just taking the time to be very explicit about, again, what the impact will be on the business at what point, so everyone understands what they're getting into.
Yeah, totally. I was going to add on to that. And I think some of the things that I personally do, and maybe also see teams with product teams, is that to avoid adding poor, because, you know, I think we're all problem solvers and we want to try to solve the problems and take all the feedback and say, can we get the solution that addresses all your needs and wants? And it ends up being this compromised solution with a little bit of that and induces that. It's almost like adding pork towards the end. And so really kind of making very clear what makes it and what doesn't, and actually being explicit, as you share, Catherine. But I think that's also just a desire to want to like take all this feedback. We could address it. We could finagle this in a way. And it comes out, it's okay to not address all the feedback, but as long as we're clear what the expectation of the milestones of what it is now, what it might will be in the future, I think that's super, super helpful.
That's a really interesting point, because I think, you know, when you're collaborating, especially as your organization gets larger and larger, as you mentioned, Jeannie, like everything eventually gets to be a compromise because you're trying to merge a bunch of different ideas. You don't want anyone to feel like they're being undervalued, particularly if they're sitting atop an organization. But you might know you're starting to go in that direction where you're getting this sort of like Frankenstein solution in order to please everybody, which isn't what you want, right? As all of you want to make the best products possible that hit goals and sort of, you know, fulfill a vision. So when you see something kind of going in that direction, have you sort of, you know, had any experiences or anecdotes of saying, well, hey, look, this is now just starting to be a little bit of what everybody wants versus something that was actually going to be really exciting based on the original vision? Have you ever had to sit people down and tell them, we're going to have to pull some of what you want out here, pull some of that. And you know, we just have to go with what I want because I sort of came up with this vision, or I'm the one in charge of executing this vision. Is there a good way to sort of like really word that and communicate it? And is there a process around that? Because it's definitely an issue that I've even on the marketing side, I've come across pretty regularly.
Yeah, I think this occurs, and maybe it's almost like a regular cleanup check that's needed. Kind of go back to that initial goal or that vision, but as Catherine said, kind of maybe reassess, could we go through all the line items here or features and see which one does apply, actually sitting the stakeholders down to, it's not necessarily about not doing it. It's just not, maybe not now. And maybe like, does it align to this vision now? I think that's one path that, you know, you just have to kind of do that regular check with the team and with the stakeholders. Are we still on that track? What got added and or not? I think there's also sometimes something else that happens is I've seen, like, you know, because of all the feedback and maybe concerns about the risk of a new feature, Catherine, or something, that the solution that the team is testing out maybe initially started out with this bold idea that might actually become more and more narrowed down to reduce risk. And then that first version that goes out doesn't actually, couldn't. So they're trying to address the feedback by then making it less and less risky or less, and that actually the feature that goes out, that first version to test is actually maybe not seeing that initial vision or impact. I think that's the other part of it as well, where the team tries to de-risk it as much as possible based on all the concerns to try to adjust it to get it out. I think that one is also very challenging. And that requires, as Catherine said, like communicating, what are we trying to do? What should we expect from the outcome right now? Managing that first version is not going to be a silver bullet, but also it shouldn't be like a misfire, a complete like not, but where are we? That's the balance, I think.
I couldn't agree more. And I thinking about experience of a two-sided marketplace, like you're always balancing both sides. And it's something we definitely struggled with a bit at First Dibs, right? Where we'd want to do something really aggressive, but you have suppliers on the other side and you can't do something that makes them mad, right? Like you're relying on them for their supply, revenue, et cetera, right? So you have to make sure the product works for them, but there's always that push and pull when you have two sides kind of working in opposition. And so we absolutely had, you know, just the challenge of things getting a little watered down, right? This is our big lofty goal. And then it's like, oh, well, will they think about this? Will this cause churn here? Will this do this? And it really took, I would say, just some very honestly strong leadership for people to go back, like we said, and say, what were our goals? And we could go this route, but it might take us a lot longer to figure this out and really sort of have some moments with the team to say, really, how risky is this? Or can we test this in a more controlled way so we still reduce some of that risk or step into it, but we're still being aggressive and not having a totally watered down approach? Because we definitely had some scenarios where something we were trying to do took way too long because we we're too risk averse for some things. And it's a challenging conversation. Absolutely.
And I wonder whether a lot of that is via the evolution of an organization as well. You mentioned people being more risk averse and, you know, Catherine, you've been in organizations that have obviously grown massively over time.
Yes.
And, you know, is it just natural that, and it is a positive thing, because when you're larger, you should think through every decision way more and have a few more checks and balances, or no, you still kind of need to be innovative to compete. And maybe that comes with, you know, removing some of the checks and balances and going a little bit faster here or there.
Well, yeah, and I thought it was interesting what you said about the stage of the company, because there were times earlier on where we had a smaller pool of suppliers, so we relied on them more. And so again, if you make them mad or they churn, it has more impact on your business, where later on, they rely more on you. So you just have more, frankly, control in the marketplace, and you're not as worried about churn. If some people churn, you've got a bunch of other suppliers and it's not as big of a deal. So, but like you said, also your later stage or public company, there are other things that you do have to think about too. So yeah, it just depends.
Makes a lot of sense. And is there room in like much, much, much later stage companies or even public companies of like, okay, this team over here is sort of just going to do things that are a little bit faster, a little bit crazier, and we need that to sort of be innovative versus some of the upstarts who are kind of coming into these spaces. But, you know, how do we also de-risk some of the things they're going to do, so it's not sort of derailing us at the stage or making us look in a certain way that we don't want to look to either investors or the public or something like that? Does that come from having to buy a company almost that's doing something completely like maybe in your space, but a little bit different, let them operate autonomously or bring them into this broader kind of like structure? Because, you know, you can kind of get on a path of like just going through a lot of the roadmap that was already there when a lot of things come in that are new in the market or there's more competition or new types of technologies that are out there. Are there some interesting things, ways to sort of address that? Maybe that's just going agile a lot more versus these lengthy plans. But I'm curious if you sort of face that and been like, wow, okay, well, the industry is moving faster than we are. So here's how we're sort of like addressing it. And maybe difficult, because I'm asking because I don't have the answer. I'm very curious if any of you do.
I can share a couple of anecdotes, and then I'm super curious what, like, Catherine and Jeannie, you've done. So I think there's two levels of it, if we were to break it down. One is, I would say, at the leadership level conversation. And then the second piece is like this operational part with the whole being agile to de-risk things. So the first part, in terms of being at the leadership level, I think the conversation is like, as a leadership, could we have intellectual honesty in terms of where we stand as a business? So like a Series A business is very different from a public company. So at Series A, and the way I have educated, or yeah, I'll just use the word educated, because we all educate each other, different functional leads educate each other on different things. So the way I've educated this is like, hey, look at it as your like investment portfolio. When you're 20 years old, you can be super aggressive. That's your like C stage. Everything is just like growing. And then when you're a little bit later, right, when you get into your 40s and 50s, that's when you're a more mature company. Like, where are we, right? Because you have more to lose right now. And your risk level does change. And it is sometimes I've seen, like, having done a couple of the growth stage companies, I could see folks, like, it's also organizationally, like, you're also evolving over time. So folks who have been there for like 6 or 7 years, they, you know, just have a, it's like, well, where are we right now? Can we do that type? So just calling it out in terms of where we are as a stage of company and what's our risk tolerance level. And sometimes, to everybody's point, it's like it's a little bit of a compromise, even on the leadership team, in terms of what risk tolerance level is. And then I am very adamant in terms of carving out that one piece, at least for innovation, whether it be a couple of squads for innovation, because you have to. Every company has to. Public companies also are innovating. And then the way that I do talk about this is like, think about it. I use money analogy a lot, which is like, if you're not investing, you're actually losing money because there's inflation going on. So I use these, I try to educate analogies that everybody can understand. And if you're thinking about this whole business as a way to invest and product as your investment areas, we should be investing in something. And then you can show tactically, you can show competitor analysis, like folks in the ecosystem, where are they investing? Not to say like you run after what they're investing, but at least just have some of that risk appetite. So I think that's at the leadership level. And then in terms of like at an operational level, I think a part of it is like when we talk about innovation, I think what's scary in terms of being risky is like, well, what are we innovating? I think that's like sometimes as humans, it's like, it seems so uncertain. Like, what are we innovating towards? So I would say that's where the product discipline does come in the sense of customer research. And some of the tactics we have used, I have used at different companies, sometimes it's like showing that vision. Like that's what product designers are amazing at, which is like, just show me a wireframe of like, what could this look like? What are we trying to do? Like a picture explains 1,000 words. So that's another way, if you will, to de-risk, to communicate. Thank you. And then the second piece around it is just everything that Catherine and Jeannie have been talking about, which is like that being more agile so that it doesn't seem like an investment doesn't see any return for like a year, but break it down. Yeah, super curious like what other folks have done.
Well, I just really want to spike what you mentioned about taking the time to build like a very, very, very basic wireframe and visual of what something could end up being, because reading a PRD or a product product requirements doc can be pretty boring and uninspiring. And also like looking at a PowerPoint deck can be pretty uninspiring. So yeah, I like that idea of taking the extra day or two to put together a wireframe with a designer so you can wow people a little bit with your vision versus just documentation.
Yeah, I mean, I think to piggyback off of what Lucy said, 100% agree on the sort of portfolio concept. You know, at First Dibs, when we'd go through planning cycles, we'd really talk about sort of the big projects and we would rate them on impact, right? You know, what is this going to be for the bottom line? But then also our confidence level as well. So we would have some things that were brand new, you know, again, risky, right? But we said, if we can do this right, this could be a big upside, right? And so as the leadership team would try to, you know, there'd be maybe one or two of those, right? Okay, let's make sure we're clear on how much we want to invest. Is it one Scrum team, PM, et cetera, for this thing? Kind of depends, right, on what it is. And then also making sure, you know, we still had our core, right? Where it's like you have these teams that can iterate and it's so much more clear because those products are built, right? You kind of have a better sense, right? Of like, okay, you can increase this by 20%. You can do X, Y, and Z. And those are reasonable goals and that will net us that. So then at the end of the day, our finance team felt, you know, I think reasonably comfortable with, okay, we feel really confident we can probably hit these things, this other stuff. Unclear, but we should at least spend some time on it and try to invest and sort of go from there. So absolutely, sort of a portfolio concept is really helpful.
That is really great. Thanks for that. It's another very lofty question. And don't feel like you have to think of only one thing. And one thing that's interesting about all three of you is that all three of you started in your career outside of product, eventually started as a product manager. I think Catherine, for you, was sales and you went into it, right? And then Jeannie was engineering and then Lucy was finance and then moved your way into it. And then, you know, V2 or V3 is like moved into leadership and executive level roles. So I don't know if it's sort of stage dependent to think about what was defining in terms of pre-product, then executive, if you want to even think of it that way. But if there were any sort of experiences that, you know, we're pretty interesting to call out.
I was thinking about this last night in terms of the experience that was most defining for me. And I would say it was working at an organization that very invested in product and product had a really big say in strategy and working for someone who had a lot of knowledge and had done product for a long time. So sort of backing that up or going back in time, like Anish said, I started in sales for Seamless, an online food ordering company. It was really growth stage early on. And for several years, even once I got into product, you know, I was reporting into CTOs, CEOs, someone that was head of strategy, right? And they were all incredibly smart and great people. And I learned a ton. But I would say it was just a different trajectory of growth to report to someone who had done product and had really focused on product. You know, my boss, many years, you know, she came from Silicon Valley and sort of grew up in product, right? And so just learning from someone like that and being at an organization, our CEO was a former product person, right? And so that just, I think you can just, the growth you get and your maturity of developing products, I really just saw that, you know, shift dramatically. So I guess my advice to someone who's earlier on their career is, it's fantastic to work for organizations that are maybe don't have a big product team and they're really small, they're sharp and they're scrappy, but think about, again, your portfolio, right? Of, you know, maybe thinking about an opportunity to work at a place with some more seasoned product people and colleagues to learn from. And I think that's a really good mix. And there's a lot more of that nowadays than there were 10 years ago. So that's good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Before this event started, we were all connecting how product is given a much higher seat at the table now, or before people maybe didn't realize the value of product 10 to 15 years ago. So that's great. Someone doesn't have to join the function and then have to fight for why their existence should even be there. Jeannie or Lucy, any thoughts from your end in terms of sort of a defining experiences or events? I know this is a pretty lofty question. So yeah, definitely cognizant of that.
I'll share what I actually thought it was going to be the end of my product career.
It already sounds fun.
I was at a startup, and it was sort of the first ones. We've been working on a project for 9 months with the team. It was super fun. It was actually really fun exploring stuff in technology with AR and music and everything. But we've been working on it for 9 months. It's been constantly delayed throughout the year. And we were going in front of the board saying it's a vision. And then I realized, you know, that December board prepare for that December board meeting, I could not go up in front again and say this is a vision strategy. And we were going off the rails, and it's really time to kill the project. We didn't achieve our goals, and we had to make that hard decision. And yeah, I honestly thought it was going to be the end of my product career, because that was time to go back to engineering possibly. And realizing, kind of having that conversation with the CEO on the board and team, who then really said, okay, then what do you want to do? I mean, really giving me and the team that chance, we went back to the drawing board. But I think the tough part was, like, we invested so much time. It was really hard to let go. It was really fun. Everybody was having fun. And what I realized is that I myself lost sight of the vision, like really getting fun to building things, kind of all this cool tech stuff that we could do, and lost sight of that. And maybe the biggest learning was that, you know, as the product manager, or we were very small, so I wouldn't say leader or anything at that point. You know, if I or you yourself don't believe in a vision, and then you can't really lead it. And what was really important is really seeing the diamond in the rough in the projects. And so kind of where are we going, and really, really keeping track of that and sharing that with the team, because we were just kind of having fun. But it was like, and then having to go through again, and then just realizing that, you know, maybe as a product leader, you don't always have that luxury. You want the team to have fun, but you may have sometimes had to make the hard decision. I'm not saying this very well, but it was a very defining moment, because, like I said, I really honestly thought it was time to call it a product career. And we're going to be like, well, okay, thanks for your services. You know, this is time to laugh. Yeah. So, but obviously the afterwards, it's like, well, what do we do now? That was also a very defining moment, what we learned when we came through from that. But that was I think having to make that decision, or having to even raise that and confront that, was really, I was scared to death. So yeah. I was like, this. So.
That's fascinating. And then, you know, so when you went through that experience, what sort of kept you on the path? Or was it just having good leaders above you who you sort of believed in you to do the next
thing? Yeah, I think it was a good leaders, a good board, good team. Cause honestly, I thought, you know, I was really brilliant. Like, I failed. It's time to let me go. And they, I'm so sorry kind of situation. And then they were like, well, okay, well, what are you going to do next? And get the team going and kind of situation. And just like, really, so what did you really believe in? And then talk to the team. So I was really fortunate to have great leaders, great support, great team. But, you know, I think maybe part of it is really just having that open, honest conversation. Know that your team have your back. It may sometimes feel really alone, maybe, right? That everything is on you. But honestly, I did not go into it thinking. And then, to be honest, Anisha, I was like, what, really? I didn't know what to do. I was like, so kind of very quickly, I did not plan that I had to solve it, really. I'm just like, I'm sorry, I failed. Yeah, it was really, I credit to the team, the leadership at that time to, I think, give me another chance maybe, or give us another chance.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I'd imagine, like, as you progress in your career, you're able to take those bumps a little bit more smoothly, right? But that was maybe one of the earliest or first times you sort of went through something like that and thought the world was going to fall apart and everything was going to fall apart. And then
it's not fun to have to kill a project, especially when it's invested so much in it across the company and the team. And what I learned is you have to just constantly check in, are we on that right path? And the earlier you can make that decision, clarify the expectations or where there's got the better, obviously, it's never, ever fun. It's never, ever, but that was a very, I would say, defining experience. Yeah.
It sounds like it. And it's great that you sort of continued on the path and didn't sort of be like, well, no, or even beat yourself up to the point of like long-term, like, well, maybe I'm just not a great product manager. Sort of like, well, things work out, things don't work out. So that's great.
Yeah. But know that your team is behind you, but also I think just you have to believe in a vision because we just got into the fun of it. But maybe it was like, wait, where are we going? So yeah.
That's fair. So Lucy, did you have any thoughts?
Sure. Yeah. But Jeannie, I think that, yeah, to your point, I think the fun of it is also important, right? Because it's also the day-to-day. But yes, the vision, the business side of things too. So I was thinking about this, which is I'll cheat and say just like two real quick ones. The first one was I spent about 5 years at CB Insight. So I was there when the team was like around $8 million in ARR and I left when it was like around like 75. So good, really good 5 years of growth. And through those 5 years, I would say it was like a very defining 5 years because and some folks who are trying, like getting into product management or the first or second product management roles is, I would say like stay nimble. Because within those 5 years, when I was growing with the team, I did like almost every type of product management. Some types I know I'm just not good at. So immediately I hired for that role. But it's like everything from like growth product management to like working with data science to like feature PM. But I would say like, if you're willing to stay nimble and if you have that opportunity with a growth stage company, like I'm super thankful for it because I think now I'm able to empathize with different types of folks on the team. So that's like super defining experience. And then the other one that I'll cheat, which is around, I went into a true startup as well, similar to Jeannie, and then we failed. So I think a part of it is I had thought about product. I also thought about product as like, oh, this is like a new company. Like, let's think about the fun of it. But then it's like, there's really that business component to it. So having to pitch to investors, that really helped me hone in the way in terms of like thinking about product as an investment. Like it how long is it going to take? Like if something takes 2 years, is that a success versus something that takes 6 months? So now those two are super defining for me.
Yeah, that was really great. And I think going back to one of the first things you mentioned in there, that is heavily something that people who have progressed in their career learn eventually is also you just happen to be good at certain things and happen to not be good at certain things. And I think my earlier bosses in my career really honed in on the things I wasn't good at and tried to fix them instead of sort of like accentuating the things that I was much more talented at. And I learned later on in my career to, as you mentioned, Lucy, hire for the things I'm not good at and really triple down on the things that I am. I think that's also a lesson for people as they grow. It's not just the idea that you're good and bad at things. It's really take the time to think about and ask yourself and put yourself in situations to learn what exactly are you good at and what exactly are you not the greatest at, and then find other people to partner with who are good at the areas that you're not. And I think a lot of people are forced to cover up the things that they're not great at because they're worried it's going to stunt their career or their boss is going to judge them poorly. And, you know, those just aren't going to be great environments for you long-term anyways, because you're trying to cover up the areas and you're trying to put time into things that you're just not the greatest at. So I think that in itself is a wonderful lesson for people across all functions, you know, figure yourself out. This one's really interesting. I think all of you touched upon this at different points, but I mean, all of you are fundamentally the product leaders of your organizations and, you know, really should be in charge of the roadmap, the vision, et cetera, obviously with buy-in from other stakeholders. But what do you do when you have the vision in your head and you've documented, you've got buy-in, and then someone who's above you in the organization walks in and says, wait, just switch what you're doing because this is kind of what I'm thinking now. How do you stop from everything being derailed or all decisions just being based on whatever the most senior person in the room says?
This is probably really, I don't have a great answer. And
it's a tough one.
The key word there is probably opinion. I think I tried to confirm. Someone said, you know, is this one person's opinion? And maybe having that conversation with the person, is this a recommendation? So we should really try to understand what is the context behind that and really evaluate, or is this actual mandate first? And so I think clarifying that is probably it's probably first, like the main thing, like when we hear like the most senior person really understand what they're saying, having that routine. But also I think the other key word here is cycle, the development cycle. Really understand, maybe point back to what Catherine brought up earlier, of what phases of the project cycle and really defining that and actually sharing that at each of those points in your development cycle. You don't want to get to right before release for that person to have seen what's going on. And so how do you really even break down the project into its project phase in the cycle, making sure you're getting that check-in every milestone in that development cycle? So maybe earlier on, that opinion could be a strong recommendation or even mandate that you could build in. But towards the end, now it's starting to become, oh, this is an opinion based on you're now in development iteration versus you're in the exploration and planning phases. So I think those are the two keywords, but it's difficult. I have to watch myself oftentimes and tell my team just one person's opinion and just sharing my feedback.
Absolutely. And I like the fact that you mentioned communication across the board and on where things are. So you're giving someone, you know, instead of one point at the very end of the cycle to put in their opinion, like, okay, here's 8 different points because I'm keeping you in the loop throughout all of that. And so don't switch everything up at point at meeting number 8 of 8. You know, if you want to switch it up, make it in like meeting 1 of 8 versus or meeting 2 of 8. So that makes a lot of sense.
The one thing I'll also share, this is way easier said than done. As product leaders, there's a way to set up the culture. I think about it as RACI model, which is like, who has the final say here? Because if you don't define that, sometimes it is the highest paid person's opinion. So for product teams to be empowered, what I do try to do to various levels of success is to actually educate the rest of the organization. I think about how do we set up the product development team for success? A part of it is defining roles and responsibilities. So otherwise the whole like feature team versus actual product management team. So it's like to say that, hey, like if we truly want to be a tech company, you know, there are some decision making points here. The key people will be consulted, but then the actual product decision come from the product manager. And then of course, it's the product manager's responsibility to articulate like how that decision is being made. But I do kind of, how do you kind of control or how do you manage that? I would say manage that sometimes that polarity of the highest paid person is to define a bit of that framework for the organization in terms of how decisions are made.
That's a really great point. It isn't necessarily just about the decision. It's about the framework that leads to it. And maybe then going back to the earlier questions, the overall goals and metrics and North Stars that you're setting for yourself and the leading back end, does this actually hit some of those North Stars versus is this just a cool idea or are you chasing a new trend? So that's really interesting there. And Jeannie also made a good point. Sometimes you're on the other side of that and you are the most senior person in the room and you come up with very quick ideas and you know you have to almost check yourself. So I think this can also be reversed. And as all of you now are fundamentally the most senior folks in the product org, how do you check yourself that you're not just sort of like walking into the room and shifting things around based on your own intuition and opinions? And so, yeah, it's difficult. And I've definitely shifted people around in circles and then realized I was wrong later on. So it's a tough one. I think Gina, you mentioned that you kind of have to let people know that like to push back on you and, you know, give their thoughts. And I think that's just kind of the best thing that you could do. Just sort of say, well, hey, I'm not 100% sure about this, but you know, this feels right, but I want to hear all of your opinions. And I want this to be something that's a conversation and I could very well be wrong here. So let me hear all the drawbacks and all of that. So yeah, this is definitely two-sided here.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I found is particularly when I'm working with product teams that report to me and in meetings with like the Scrum team, the engineers and the designers, I can tell that sometimes they don't feel sometimes they just don't feel quite as comfortable pushing back. You know, there's just a variety of personalities and it really depends on the team. So like Jeannie suggested, I've really had to be very explicit, right? When I'm having those conversations and saying, you know, they'll say something, I'll be like, okay, I don't totally agree. Here's why, blah, blah, blah. But then saying, someone debate me. Like, I really want to have a debate about this or what am I missing or something like that. Like, I really would love to hash this out because I only have a high level understanding and you guys are in the nitty gritty and really reinforce that they are the ones that are in the day-to-day. They probably see all the nitty gritty metrics and understand the architecture and all of that. So just using that language with people, I think over time it makes the team more comfortable. You know, anyone from like very junior members of the team wanting and feeling comfortable and to speak up if we're like actually really missing this other point here. So, because you can't understand all of that once you get to a certain level.
Yeah. It's almost like earlier we started this call about how do you level people up internally who might be reporting to you, and like, you know, promotions is one thing. If only there was like a metric of like how often someone corrects you, like on a weekly basis, that could be a really fun metric to try to track. So, and that's how you know that someone has grown really, really phenomenally when they're sort of outpacing you, and yeah, you can go and focus on other things. I think all of you are talking about the transition from jumping into product when you first started, and like who tried to learn, whether it's books or meetups and all of that. It seems like you've all sort of tried different things. So what has actually hit in terms of this has taught me more about product, you know, whether it's going and talking to people, doing one-on-one chats with other people in industry, podcasts, books, communities. Would love to hear kind of how your growth has happened. And also things maybe you tried and didn't really get you as sort of knowledgeable, but maybe you thought it would.
I think actually talking to people not in tech, this is very difficult, or not directly related to a specific product development, has been really helpful. Just like completely different professions or industries of how they approach it. Kind of, there's always like similarities in an online way of how things work, right? So that I always find really, really interesting, but it's difficult to do, especially I'm in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, but you know, finding people in completely different professions just give you a different perspective. And some of the problem spaces are in terms of organization, how people work together, very similar still.
That's super interesting that you've actually learned how to be a better product leader from people outside of your specific function. Because oftentimes when people are networking, I find that they very much are just like, I want someone who's been at these certain areas that are similar to mine in certain companies that are similar to mine. So I like that you actually take inspiration and knowledge from other far-reaching professions.
Yeah, and I think along those same lines, our team has tried to bring in basically just like people from our network we're trying to do on a regular basis, but like it could be people on product, but to Jeannie's point, it was someone who was maybe like founders were always really interesting to, you know, speak with, whether they failed, whether they did well, just like learning from their experiences. And, you know, even if small team, you look at your network of people, like I'm sure you can find many people, friends and old colleagues who've done interesting things. And, you know, it was always great to bring them in with the team and sort of have just a small discussion and keep it super casual. And I found those to be just really inspiring conversations. And sometimes they did get in depth and they're really specific and to product, but sometimes they're just really interesting conversations about something that's just a little bit tangential, but that I've always found that really inspiring and just helpful because it is a small group type conversation. So you can really, you know, chat about things, which is nice.
That's great. I could speak a little bit to it. I think what's been hit or miss for me has been blogs or one-to-many communications, because I feel like they tend to be edited to make someone or some organization maybe look a little better than they really are. But when I've actually talked to people who either work at those organizations or the actual authors of these blogs, I'm able to get a little bit of an actual story of what actually went right or went wrong. So where my learning curve has bumped up was getting, you know, 30-minute coffees or 30-minute Zooms with people who are just generally interesting and have done interesting things, regardless of whether it's in my function. And the real story, like I really, within the first 5 minutes, try to get, okay, tell me the real story. What actually worked? What didn't work? You know, what wasn't written? And that's where it gets to be pretty fun, because I'm able to utilize those learnings where they're definitely keeping a lot of those pieces of knowledge outside of their one-to-many communications. Any other kind of areas for inspirational learnings or certain books that you think have been like, this kind of taught me a good amount about product management and got me on the right path or communities or anything like that?
If interested, I can share a list of who I follow and my team. This is credit to the team. There's like a whole product resource library in terms of who to follow for what. It's a pretty robust list. For me as a product leader, I would have to double down on what Jeannie and Catherine said, which is it's actually more helpful to talk to leaders in CEOs, founders, leaders in other functional areas, because yeah, as a product leader, it's assuming you have most of the product chops by now. And a lot of it is how do you become a better leader a lot of the times?
That's a great point. Especially when you're at your level, your goal is becoming a great leader, not just learning the very, very basics of product management anymore. So that's wonderful. From Mark, what's your recommendation on figuring out if maybe what the HIPPO is asking for is an opinion versus a mandate?
I think that that was definitely one of the things you have to have that conversation, get that alignment and kind of going through and really just understanding. I think most of the times also trying to really find out why, like ask, well, why is this so important to really understand? Because oftentimes I find that even I myself or the leaders, they're thinking of something else and what comes out as a solution or idea. And but really what's the concern or worry is what you're trying to, so what questions or what concerns for that? And I think that's the main thing too. At least even for myself, I had to be like, wait, what, I'm just kind of moving so fast, coming up with that solution, but the reason behind it.
Yeah, a really talented person I used to work with would come back and just ask when I would have, you know, requests that would be all over the place. What is your actual goal? You know, what are you looking for with it? Not what the executable portion is, but what is the actual goal? So that it made the conversation be a little bit more reframed. And I think that helps kind of understand whether something's a mandate versus an opinion. And I think we talked a little bit with the anecdotes of defining moments, but were there some initial challenges? Or, and if so, what were they when you first transitioned from other functional areas to product management? I think you talked a little bit about, you know, learning the technical side and the engineering side, Lucy, but if there were any other kind of like hurdles that were very, very much present when you're first starting off.
I think for me, the one that stands out is years ago, getting feedback from someone, I was just starting to manage someone. It was my first time managing with no training whatsoever, obviously. And getting feedback that I was micromanaging them. And I was really quickly went for, you know, I was an individual contributor and I kind of just ran with that, right? So it was honestly, you know, it took me like 24 hours to kind of absorb it. And then it wound up being a fantastic conversation and being able to go back to that person the next day and say, I really appreciated that feedback. And I knew I could just, all right, I could change a lot of things that I was doing. And it really changed my approach to managing product managers because PMs, they want autonomy. They want to solve their own problems. Like they don't want to be micromanaged and you shouldn't need to. So just in terms of how you know, give them guidance and be someone to, you know, be a mentor and someone that they can debate with, but you're not managing their day to day, right? So that mm-hmm. I think was just an early bump when going from being an IC to managing someone and some very talented people that can definitely do their job.
Yeah, which is a great bump to kind of get over and learn how to improve on. Cool. I think we're here at time. So I want to definitely thank you, Catherine. Definitely want to thank you, Jeannie and Lucy, who just had to hop and jump into the next thing. I'll thank her separately. But this was a really great event. I think for a lot of folks who are trying to get to your levels, they were able to take a lot away. So thank you both.
Yeah, thank you, Anish and Casey, for setting this up. And thanks, Catherine and Lucy. It was great learning for me as well. So it's fantastic.
Thank you both for being here. And yes, I'm sorry, Lucy had to hop, but thank you everyone for attending. This was such a meaningful conversation. I know I learned a ton. Thank you all for joining us.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.